without resorting to closed-loop type setting, i.e. do everything in open loop without any feedback. And what I'd like to talk about today is a way of doing that, so-called dynamical decoupling scheme, and in particular, the version that we came up with a couple of years ago, which is what we call concatenated dynamical decoupling, which does exhibit a certain degree, low level of fault tolerance and robustness. So just to fix the notation, this is the usual system math paradigm, where the total Hamiltonian is composed of a system term. And here I include the control Hamiltonian, which is going to generate pulses for us, or escapes if you wish. And then there is the error term, which is the pure bath Hamiltonian and the system bath Hamiltonian. And for this entire talk, I will only be talking about a single qubit coupled to an arbitrary node. So for a single qubit, I'll sometimes write, instead of h bath, I'll just write b sub 0. And then notice, by the way, that the bath operator is here on the left here. Apologize for any confusion that might cause. And then it's a qubit, so we have the Pauli sigma x, sigma y, and sigma z operators, and corresponding bath operators. And as we all know, the errors come from faulty controls, so that's inaccurate H control here, and this error Hamiltonian. Now, typically, the focus is only on the system bath Hamiltonian when we talk about errors generated by the environment, but as you'll see, because generically the bath Hamiltonian doesn't commute with the system bath Hamiltonian, the bath Hamiltonian too has an impact at second order or third order. Okay, so just for people who are not familiar with dynamical decoupling, here is the simplest setting, which goes all the way back to the 1950s NMR. For example, the so-called CPNG sequence, Carpenter-Stahl, McGill, I believe, or the spin echo experiment due to Irving Hahn, who won the Nobel Prize for it. And the idea is to find a pulse p, which has the property that if you apply it before and after the evolution, here I've written just the Hamiltonian, it flips the sign on the Hamiltonian. So obviously this is some kind of time reversal. And you can see that if you evolve forward in time, backward in time, forward backward, you will cancel the undesired evolution. That's the idea here. And for later purposes, it's convenient to note that this is just the notion that the pulse operator anti-commutes with the system math Hamiltonian. So here's a picture to illustrate this. Free evolution interrupted by pulses. The free evolution takes time tau. And one cycle is free evolution pulse, free evolution pulse. Now, here's why it works. Formally, this is the time reversal argument. Take the free evolution for a time tau, apply a pulse, free evolution again, pulse. And now you can lift the p and the p dagger upstairs into the exponential, so that's up here. Now, assuming that we picked our p such that it flips the sign, as here, then we now get a plus here, and these two cancel and we get identity. So this is the basic intuition. And at some level, that's all there is to it. However, I've made dramatic simplifying assumptions here. My pulses are assumed to take zero time, i.e. they have zero width. And I've also ignored the bath Hamiltonian in writing out this calculation. So now let's see what happens when you still, here's an example. Purity phasing Hamiltonian. So Hamiltonian is now the system operator appears on the left again. So the purity phasing sigma z, and you can easily show that by applying an x pulse, so a pi pulse on the x direction of the block sphere, because x and z anti-commute, we have exactly this time reversal operation. So this H system bath Hamiltonian is averaged to zero, but as is noted here, this is only in the first order magnitude expansion. So now let's take a look at this a bit more carefully. Okay, so here I've written down the same sequence again, but now, while I still assume that my pulses have zero width, so this delta is zero, I do take into account the fact that the bath Hamiltonian is in fact on during the evolution. And you will see that this messes up the ideal performance of the sequence. So I don't have time to go through this calculation, but you'll have to trust me that when you lift these x's upstairs here and work this out to second order in tau again is the pulse interval, what you get is, because now the Bath Hamilton function, pure Bath Hamilton function is present, that's this B0 term. So this has no effect, of course, on our qubit. This is pure Bath, identity acts on our qubit. But in addition, we have this extra term here, which comes from the commutator of the pure Bath term, that's B0, with the Bath operator that was coupled to sigma z. So we have this commutator. If it doesn't vanish, this spoils our perfect pulse sequence, because we now have an error, a z error, that was not canceled. Okay, so this is the effect of including the pure Bath Hamiltonian, and we can write this down in terms of an effective Hamiltonian. I've written down 2 tau here, because we're looking at the evolution at the end of 2 periods tau. And this effective Hamiltonian is basically given here, divided by tau, multiplied by I. So this is the effective Hamiltonian, and this error term, B prime is the, I call it, this error term, this is an operator on the Bath, its norm, just the norm of this commutator, is bounded by the product of these two norms. Okay, so this is the error that is introduced, even for zero width pulses, in the presence of the Bath Hamiltonian. Now, if you take into account the width of the pulse, so set delta not equal to zero, what you'll find, and I'll show you in more detail later, is that there is an additional per pulse error, and this error is similar in nature to the gate error that we're used to from photon quantum computation. Okay, so in order to now perform a more rigorous analysis and to show you how concatenating pulse sequences eventually will lead to an improvement, I have to introduce some notation. So I'm going to characterize the strength of the various interaction terms by two numbers, J, which is the maximum of these various Bath operators. Again, I remind you, these are the Bath operators coupled to the system operators in the system Bath Hamiltonian. That's J. And then beta is going to denote the norm of the pure Bath Hamiltonian. Now, of course, here you have to be a bit careful because, in principle, the Bath can be the entire universe, and this norm will be rather large. So what you need to do is you need to introduce appropriate cutoffs which describe whatever energy scale, whatever geometric constraints there are on the coupling of the system in the Bath. So then this beta becomes finite. Now here's the key observation. In similar fashion to what happens in quantum error correction, as we heard in John Preskill's talk this morning, there is a renormalization effect taking place. So after we apply a single cycle of this pulse sequence, this J, we can show, let's call it J sub zero, becomes J1, where J1 is the original J multiplied by the following. Tau, again, is the pulse interval. C and D are numbers which are model-dependent and are hopefully not too large, but in certain cases we check they are order 1 or 10 or so. And then the maximum of beta, which is the number of Bath Hamiltonian, times J0. So this is a renormalization effect. Well, this is due to the pulse width. So it can pretty much be safely ignored. Yeah, if delta is small compared to tau. So this is the renormalization effect. J goes to J times tau times, let's say, J. So J goes to J squared tau. That's the renormalization effect, provided this number is smaller than 1. Now, interestingly, it's not just the coupling between system and Bath that gets renormalized. The pure Bath Hamiltonian, too, gets renormalized upwards, but fortunately by just a small factor, and this is, you can think of it just as a lamb shift calculation. Okay, so now when you look at this, immediately you want to somehow concatenate, because you want to take this and turn it into recursion, which is going to make this renormalization effect happen super exponentially, like we're used to in concatenated error correction. Now it will turn out that this is not quite possible. We can do something not too far. Okay, so here's the simplest dynamical decoupling strategy, the decades-old periodic dynamical decoupling known from NMR. And what it is simply to repeat this basic cycle, let's say the CPMG cycle, n times. So now, I'm going to assume that the total duration of the pulse sequence is fixed. So the total duration of the pulse sequence is going to be T, capital T. And I will assume that I have the flexibility to change the pulse interval, or in other words, the number of pulses being plotted. Okay? So tau is the pulse interval, it's a variable, total time t is 6. And I want to define a very simple error. And that error is just the norm of the effective Hamiltonian. Remember the effective Hamiltonian that I got in the turbulent analysis that I showed you before. At the final time t times the total time t. So this is dimensionless. And obviously some kind of measure of error. If this effective Hamiltonian were 0, then we would have ideal decoupling. So we would like to make this error as small as possible. So, and the initial error then, because we didn't do any renormalization, the norm of the effective Hamiltonian would be J, the original. And again, assuming that J is greater than beta, so let's take it as J, times the total time t. Now, what happens when you do periodic dynamical decoupling, PDD? What you can show is that the final error, due to this renormalization that took place, it's easiest to look at it here, the final error divided by the initial error scales like 1 over n. N is the number of pulses in a fixed time interval. It's a fixed total experiment. So by introducing more and more pulses for fixed total experiment time, we can reduce the error. But the reduction is done only by this 1 over n type. And that's nice, but it raises the question whether we can do better. There's something you can do immediately to do better, which is to use a so-called palindromic sequence, which reads the same left to right. And that will take this to n squared, n to the minus 2. But can we do better than just polynomial improvements? OK, so here's where the concatenation idea comes in. And again, it's just our renormalization idea. So the simplest instance would be to take the CPMG sequence and to concatenate it. And by concatenation here, I mean the following. Take the free evolution period. This is the simple CPMG sequence, free x, free x. And just plug this sequence, p1, into the free evolution periods. So this is the recursion. And you see this goes on like that. So that's the recursive construction of the pulse. And you can simplify it and take into account that x squared is identity, and then you get these pulse sequences. Incidentally, this one is palindromic, so already you can see that it should improve things a little bit. But the third one is not palindromic. It doesn't have a simple periodic structure, and so on. So this is one concatenation, but it only works against purely phasing errors. Now, what about a sequence that works against arbitrary single qubit errors? So you can do that, too. And it turns out that this sequence, which has nice symmetry arguments behind it that I don't have time to explain, this sequence will cancel an arbitrary single qubit error to first order. This is known as the universal decoupling sequence that was introduced in paper by Viola, Canella, and Lafond a few years ago. So let's concatenate this sequence with itself. And again, the idea is every free evolution period, let's plug in the lower level sequence, etc. So if you work it out simplified, you get following, and you see these are long sequences. Obviously, the length goes exponentially. Now, the question is, do we gain anything compared to the periodic decoupling? We've increased the decoupling time exponentially, or if you wish, since I said total time is fixed, we've decreased the pulse interval exponentially. How much did we gain in terms of error reduction? That's the key question. Okay, so here is a table to help you remember what all the various quantities are. Now, here's another table that shows you what happens. So this table is true for the CPMG sequence, but something very similar happens for the universal decoupling sequence. Okay, so if I assume that J, the BAF norm, the system BAF norm, is much greater than the BAF norm, the first order sequence gives us a tau j squared. Second order sequence gives us a tau j to the fourth. And by induction, you might think that this is this goes super exponentially, but it's not that good. It goes like this, in the limit that little n is log big n, so little n is the concatenation level. So this is what you get in this limit when j is greater than beta. In the opposite limit, you get something similar, and here you already see that indeed it's not super exponential the way that it scales. Now, both of these results can be summarized in the following key formula, and this is really the take-home message from this talk. Unlike the periodic decoupling scheme, where we had a reduction in the error that goes like 1 over n, and again, big N is the number of pulses, here we have a reduction that goes like n to the minus log n. So this is not super exponential, but it's super polynomial. Right? This is better than any polynomial in n. And this is what I call the low-level fault tolerance, or the rather, the robustness, I should call it. This is not really fault tolerance. This is the robustness. We have a very dramatic improvement in these concatenated pulse sequences over periodic pulse sequences in terms of how the error scales down with the number of pulses. Okay, so this result is based on a perturbative analysis up to second order in the Magnus expansion, and then we can show that the second order always remains dominant when we do concatenations, so we don't have to worry about the higher orders. But nevertheless, it is a perturbative analysis. We don't have an exact analytical proof to all orders. So in order to get beyond the perturbation theory, we did numerically exact simulations. And the model we took is inspired by, for example, this paper, where there are many other papers that talk about the gallium-arsenide spin qubits, electron spin qubits. So the situation is that we have a single electron spin, which is surrounded by a bath of nuclear spins. And the dominant decoherence mechanism is hyperfine coupling between the bath nuclear spins and our single electron spin. And under standard parameters, the radius of this electron wave function includes about 10 to the 4, 10 to the 5 nuclear spins. So when you take that into account, you find that J is on the order of a megahertz, and beta, the pure bath, is on the order of 10 kilohertz. So this is what I meant by introducing appropriate cutoffs. The cutoff is all of the bath spins that you include in this envelope. When you sum over about 10 to the 4, 10 to the 5 nuclear spins, this is how you come up with that number. So we're in a regime where J is significantly larger than beta. Okay, so now we did numerically exact simulations, not exactly for this model where there are 10 to the 5 nuclear bath spins, because that's too large. Instead, we took a linear chain, and we included a single electron spin qubit surrounded by a small number, order less than 10. Nuclear spins, but with Heisenberg coupled interactions, so that coupling between the electron and the nuclei is Heisenberg, by the way. This term is the internal bath, and that's a dipolar coupling, and we accounted for that as well in our simulation. So we have dipolar coupling between the bath, the qubits, Heisenberg coupling between the electron and the nuclear qubits, and these are the simulation results. So these are numerically exact simulation results, and I apologize for how crowded this is, but try to help you figure it out. So on the y-axis, we have log of lack of purity. This is log base 10. Okay, so it's not the error that I defined before. This is a more natural error. It's lack of purity, 1 minus trace rho squared, log base 10. And on this axis, we have concatenation level. And concatenation level means log base 4 of the number of pulses used. So concatenation level makes sense, obviously, for concatenated sequences. For periodic sequences, this just means 6 here means that we used 4 to the power 6 pulses, with the same total pulse sequence length as in a concatenated case. Now, this curve here, which goes down node to 10 to the minus 70, so Ben did simulations 45 significant digits. We did 70 significant digits here. you see the behavior of the concatenated pulse sequence. The purity goes down astronomically. Impurity goes down astronomically as we increase the concatenation level for ideal pulses, zero width pulses. So this works really, really well. On the other hand, periodic decoupling, which is the dotted dashed red line here, doesn't do as well. And in fact, this curve and this curve follow the theoretical predictions very nicely. So when you translate this error figure of merit to purity, then this is a log scale. This should be quadratic, and that's exactly what's observed So you see here a numerical proof for the improvement offered by concatenation. And then the other curves, which are blown up here, are what happens when you have finite pulse width. So finite pulse width means that not only is the bath on between pulses, but it's also on during the pulse, and the system bath interaction is also on during the pulse. That's what that means in terms of our simulation. And now you see that rather than going down forever, concatenation helps you up to a certain point, and then the smaller you make the pulse width, the lower the impurity goes, and then it flattens out. And what happens is, the reason this is happening is because what concatenation does is basically fixes errors at different magnification levels, if you wish. So the first level of concatenation fixes errors that have low frequency, and then the next level slightly higher frequency and higher frequency, et cetera, et cetera. And then at some level, you reach the highest frequency, which is your pulse width, and you can't do any better than your own pulse width. So that's why it flattens out. On the other hand, the periodic scheme, the reason you see these oscillations, these are not really oscillations, these are random fluctuations. What happens is that the errors start to build up kind of like a random walk. So the purity takes a random walk in this space. Quickly two more slides showing numerical data. This is for a slightly different system, but it's a similar concept. Here we checked the performance of concatenated versus periodic pulse sequences against random noise in the pulse. So this means that every pulse is slightly different, and the pulses and the noise is picked at random. It's not systematic. It's picked at random. So it's kind of adversarial noise, I guess, in the language of our approach. And again, you see here a log 10 of the impurity versus roughly this is the probability of error, or more precisely, it's the fraction of noise divided by the norm of the Hamiltonian of generating the pulse. So, and this shows the level 4 concatenation result versus the periodic pulses. And you see that at very low noise levels, concatenation does a couple of orders of magnitude better than periodic pulse sequences. And then interestingly, at high noise, they perform about the same. And while it shouldn't surprise you that the pulse sequence does worse as you increase the noise level, it should surprise you that pulse sequence does better as you increase the noise level. But this is due to a well-known effect, which is that randomization for periodic pulse sequences actually helps to some extent in a high noise regime. And that's simply because, you have random noise, so you might as well apply random pulses to deal with it. There's a paper, again, by Viola and Knill from several years ago where they did some analytical work on randomized periodic pulse, random pulse sequences. Okay, so last slide is the performance of concatenated decoupling with random noise as a function of concatenation level. And this is concatenation level, and this is the noise level again. And you see that there's a monotonic improvement in the purity as you increase the concatenation level. And then at fixed concatenation level, and of course, the behavior deteriorates somewhat. But we can get to extremely low impurities as we increase concatenation. Okay, so let me finish by making a few remarks about where I see this going next. Going back to the motivation for this talk, which is that it's hard to full-blown Falcone quantum error correction with encoding, I'd like to suggest that a hybrid of these two strategies, concatenated decoupling with quantum error correction, concatenated decoupling used at a low level, and on top of that, the error correction, this strategy seems pretty optimal. And the reason is, well, these are, the merits of concatenated decoupling, but in addition, to these three points. The fourth point is that dynamical decoupling, in particular concatenated dynamical decoupling, operates under pretty similar assumptions about pulse speed and strength compared to the assumptions used in quantum error correction. So remember that what we needed was the norm of the system bath Hamiltonian times time, and in our case, time is the total pulse sequence length rather than the pulse duration itself. But it's the norm of the system bath Hamiltonian that enters at a basic level. That norm has to be small, and this is an assumption that goes into the fault tolerance groups for non-Jacobian norms. And then an open question, which I'd really like to throw out to this audience, is what would be the fault tolerance threshold in this hybrid set, where we use concatenation decoupling at the lowest level and error correction on top? And my guess is that this should help. I certainly have no proof, but the intuition is that the concatenation decoupling is a lot less expensive than doing error correction, and it reduces the norm of the effect of not Hamiltonian, and therefore this should help in improving the threshold. Then one problem which has to be dealt with is that the dynamical decoupling pulses can actually interfere with the gates, or what I call computational pulses here. Dynamical decoupling, in principle, without encoding, is going to eliminate the computational operations as well. The universal decoupling sequence kills everything. So how are you going to apply the logic gates? So this is an idea that we wrote down a couple of years ago, and unfortunately have made zero progress on. But the idea is, I think, basically correct, that in order to reconcile computation with dynamical decoupling, we have to encode, actually. And the intuition is, let's say that we use, as pulses, we use the stabilizers of an error-correcting code. While these stabilizers, as we know, anti-commute with the errors of that code, or that code corrects, and anti-commutation of pulses with errors is exactly the dynamical decoupling problem. That's time reversed. So the stabilizers should be used as dynamical decoupling pulses, and then we can apply normalizers that commute with our stabilizers as computational gates, or as computational Hamiltonians, and that would have universality. And the final question is, can we do better than CDD? Can we do better than concatenation dynamical decoupling? In other words, this error scaling n to the minus log n, maybe we can do better than that. Maybe we can truly get a super exponential type of improvement in the error, like we see in concatenated error correction. There's one recent paper by an author whose name I forgot, recent TRL, in which that was indeed shown for a very particular model, a spin boson model with purity phasing. And by using the symmetries of that model to an extreme, he was able to show indeed exponential improvement rather than super polynomial improvement. And however, while we tried to generalize this, we couldn't do it. So it may be a special instance of a very particular model. So I think that's it, except that I wanted to say one last thing. I got permission from Debbie earlier on, so I hope I won't steal the thunder from this meeting. So this is a small advertisement for a conference we're holding at USC in December. Many of you are going, I know that, because you're giving talks. And for those who are not going or didn't know, this is the advertisement that's online, and I hope everybody can come and participate. Thank you.
Have you studied the robustness of the dynamical decoupling with respect to the imperfect pulses? And do you know if one is more robust than the other?
That's what this is. Obviously, energy best. That's what this is. Random noise means random noise on the pulse.
On the pulse.
Yes, okay. On the pulse.
Okay. What is the noise model for the pulse? And what is the parameter on the horizontal axis?
For every pulse, we pick an arbitrary linear combination of x, y, and z, and the norm of coefficients is this W.
So when you do the pulse, then basically have an error pulse.
So this h, p is the ideal pulse Hamiltonian. We add to this.
Oh, okay, good. Okay.
This quantity is what I call WPSA.
So there's these lower bounds on Trotter-Suzuki extensions. do they, would that be a limitation to what kind of error scaling you can get with dynamic decoupling?
You can choose to use either Toyota Suzuki or Magnus, and at the second order, it really doesn't matter.
Yeah.
It's possible, and we tried, and in fact, in the recent Fisher of A, we gave a Trotter Suzuki based dynamical decoupling sequence, which does perform better than the concatenated sequence, but it's less robust to error in the pulses.
Sure. Right, but, okay, that's in terms of doing better, but the limitations. There's upper limit on how well you can do with a Trotter Suzuki type expansion. I guess you're saying that you can do more general things than, since you can do more general things in Trotter Suzuki, those limitations may not apply to your decoupling.
Are you talking about the convergence of the expansion? I'm not sure what you mean by doing better.
Well, if you want to, so, yeah, I mean, the way they, I mean, they're expansions in terms of parameter for a small Hamiltonian strength. And if the Hamiltonian strength is epsilon, you'd like the error to go like epsilon to the n. And then if you want to get that, then the number of pulses you have to do is something like n factorial.
You're talking about Brown, Chuang, were you on that paper as well? Composite pulse paper. This is not composite pulse.
Oh, yeah. But that's not even for, yeah, so we use Trotter Suzuki for composite pulses, but I mean, this n factorial limitation is just on, on Trotter Suzuki expansions, which is much more general. Okay, but you're saying it maybe doesn't apply to yours.
Yeah, I'm still not sure exactly what you mean by improvement. Why don't we do that offline?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I have a question about speed limits. I guess a more practical question. There are many sorts of errors that I guess the relevant parameter is the bandwidth of the bath, which can be really fast for certain errors.
Mm-hmm.
And that places an undue burden on the rapidity at which you're going to put the pulse. And I mean, you're getting a fascinating example. There's only the coupling was only 10 megahertz or something. There, right? So you only had to.
Yeah.
One megahertz. So that implies bandwidth is no bigger than 1 megahertz?
Well, okay, now we have to be very careful about what we mean by bandwidth. So, are you talking about the high frequency cutoff of the bath spectral
right.
density?
Yes.
Yeah. So, it's actually not trivial to translate this analysis to that language of spectral densities. And I think it's similar to, again, Cohen's second or third problem. How to formulate quantum computation in terms of spectral densities. And I don't know how to do it. We are actually working on doing that right now for Spinbogomov. So it's hard for me to answer that question. I don't actually know how to translate our bounds into spectral densities and high frequency cutoffs.
Another example that's very relevant in quantum optical systems is spontaneous emission, where the bandwidth is 10 to 14 hertz.
Mm-hmm.
But the rate at which it occurs directly can be very slow.
Well, spontaneous emission is highly Markovian, and none of this works for Markovian error.
Unless you can do way past.
Yeah, within the Zeno time. That's basically, so maybe this is an answer to your question. So all of this works essentially within the Zeno time.
So on the very last point, or one of the very last points about combining error correction and dynamic decoupling, do you suggest doing gates for the normalizer?
Either gates, or if you could make the Hamiltonian from the normalizer, then you'd have the universal set.
Okay, so that kind of answers my question. The question is how to go beyond the Clifford group.
And right. Yeah. Now, of course, the normalizer can take many body interactions. If you do the Hamiltonians, that would be a problem. That's why we've been stuck on this for a couple of years.
Okay, maybe I have a comment to that. I think what you're suggesting here, namely applying your bang-bang pulses from the stabilizer group, is a clash with transversality gates. For example, if the conditional phase gate is transversal, it is only transversal, depends on the code, but in general it's only transversal for conditional phase pi. So what's happening is that you take your code space, you leave the code space, and after phase pi, go back in the code space if you do the gate transversal, which is certainly something desirable. So in the meantime, when you're out of the code space, your stabilizer pulses will still occur the gates. And that is if the normalizer is applied in Hamiltonian. If the normalizer is actually applied as a pulse, and then it commutes.
Well, so that is. That
would not be a transversal operation then. If you would do the C naught in such a way that it would continuously stay in the code space, and then I think you lose the error correction properties.
I agree. Yeah, we've been stuck on this problem, and it seems to be hard.
If I could just ask, what do you mean exactly by the dynamical decoupling pulses interfere with your computational pulses? If I think about dynamical decoupling in the traditional NMR ESR sense, where what I'm doing is flipping the spin over along each axis so that I average out whatever random magnetic field I have, can't I think of dynamical decoupling as just changing my reference frame, so I'm just rotating my blocks here around so that I average out environmental effects?
Yeah, so
and then I insert my computational pulse now, and then my problem is that I accumulate error from the bath during my computational pulse because I'm no longer averaging out during that time interval.
That's right. So you could, at the end of a dynamical decoupling cycle, you could insert a very fast computational pulse and then apply the next dynamical decoupling sequence.
Right, so I'm adding like a small bias. You're a dynamical decoupling sequence.
Yeah.
It's something that should have the spin sitting in each direction on average the same amount of time. And now, if I have a sequence of n pulses, I add one computational pulse and I change that bias by a factor of 1 over n.
Yeah, that's right. But then the issue is that I can't guarantee that this computational pulse or gate is going to have any kind of fall off. Because you're just inserting it at the end of a period where we think that the purity of our qubit is high. So, in order to make it fall tolerant, you would have to introduce a whole error correction circuit at that point, which might take too long. So there are trade-offs.
Yeah, but presumably the purity is sort of at a constant level throughout this whole process. I mean, that's
the kind of thing. The purity is high stroboscopically, right? Just like an error correction. At the end of the cycle, the purity is high. But I can't guarantee anything while the cycle is happening.
Well, during the ESR and NMR, when I think about what a spin actor is, I know where the spins, I know the spins are going to come back within that time interval. The time interval corresponds to the rotation.
Yeah, they'll come back for a brief moment, and then they will.
Right, so I put my computational pulse when I know what my reference frame is, which is only at the discrete.
This is a viable strategy, but in order to make it fall tolerant, you'd have to do a lot during that brief instance. And we don't have enough time in this setting. So it would be better if we could just seamlessly integrate the computational operations into the pulse sequence. And that's why this stabilizer normalizer.
Okay, so thanks.